Okay, this is the beginning of tape two, and I'm speaking with Sonia Sokolov, and you were discussing being put into second grade after the summer vacation when you had first arrived.
Yes. I was in the second grade and feeling 10 feet tall among the little children, and not being very happy about that. But eventually, by Christmas time, I guess, I was put into the third grade. And then at the end of the school year, I went into the fourth grade. Then the second year, I spent some months in the fourth grade, and then was put into the fifth grade, then the sixth grade, and by the end of that year, I was put into the seventh grade.
Which was about with your age group?
Which was about my age group. But, no, wait a minute. No. I was put into the seventh grade for a very short time. But as I told you, I had a tutor. By that time, we all did.
Now, how did that work? Where did you meet with the tutor, and who else was there?
The tutor had this tutoring school. He had been he had been superintendent of schools at one time. He was sort of an old man by the time that happened, and I guess to supplement his meager pension, he had this little school, night school, tutoring school. And we went there. He didn't charge very much because we didn't have very much money. We went there and he would tutor us a little bit, not very much, but what he did do was that he hastened our going through the grades, you know, 1, 2, 3. And when I got into the seventh grade in beginning of May, I guess it was, where my cousin was at that time. I came up with her, and she said, "Oh well, I'll be going into the eighth grade in June, but you won't." And I said, "What makes you think I won't?" And she said, "Oh, I don't think you will. You don't know enough." So when I told him that, he said, "I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to pass into the eighth grade." He said, "Don't worry about it." And he called and, you know, fixed it. So I was.
And
I went into the eighth grade.
What did you learn with the tutor?
Not very much. Really not very much. But he gave us confidence. He did that. And you know, when they speak about now this bilingual education, I'm inclined to to disapprove. Because I think the children who are on the bilingual education never really get to speak English the way Americans do. And I think that is not a good thing for their ego. I think if they're left alone to their own devices, no, I don't think they should be left alone. I think they should be provided with a tutor when they need one, but not bilingual education.
Can you think of how your ego changed from the time you first came here and as you became acclimated and moved along in school and in life?
Oh, yes. Yes, there are. When I felt that that people could not differentiate between me and somebody who was born here, I felt I had arrived. And I think I have always been very careful about my addiction. Oh, when I was in the eighth grade, I was there for a whole year. And the teacher in the eighth grade was the daughter of this tutor. Now, they were, she was born and educated in Boston. And I liked the way she spoke. I liked the way she sounded. And I would emulate her. She had a great deal to do with my desire to not even sound like North Adams, which was not the mecca of the world. Oh, wait, I shouldn't say these things. I don't know who's going to listen to me. But it was, her name was Miss Hall. Ruth Hall. And she influenced me a great deal. She was, and she was always very nice to me.
So you saw her as a sophisticated person.
She was not a sophisticated person. She was a school teacher. And a school teacher in Massachusetts in those days was a certain type of person. Yeah. Was very, almost like a nun. First of all, school teachers did not get married in Massachusetts in those days. They were all unmarried women. So they were regarded as sort of strange or above the ordinary woman. I only remember one married teacher when I was in high school, and she was a widow. It was not until after the Second World War, when there was a shortage of teachers, that they finally took off the ban.
You mean they had to be unmarried?
They had to be unmarried, yes. It was in those days they felt that a married woman was supported by her husband.
Can you think of ways in which your mother and father, or ways that they held on to that were from the old country, from Russia? Or maybe attitudes that they held?
I think they lived their life as immigrants. I think they never aspired. My parents did not aspire to be Americans. I think my mother did the best she could. She tried. My mother was fashion conscious because she sewed, and she always had the latest Buttrick fashion little magazine that was given away when you bought a yard of goods. And she sewed for all of us. Until I graduated high school, I never had a dress that was bought in the store. She sewed, she did not buy 3 yards of something or other. She found a remnant, which she pronounced remnich, and she made clothes out of that. And later on in life, she always made a little quilt for a grandchild. If a grandchild was coming, she immediately went to the store and got either pink or blue sateen or satin or something and made a little quilt for the baby. And I remember it was one of the later babies that she was working very hard to piece out this little quilt, and I said to her one day, why don't you, by that time she could have gone and bought several yards of cloth, why don't you go and buy as much cloth as you need for this instead of working so hard trying to make something out of nothing? She said, well, that would not be any fun. It was always a challenge to her to make something out of nothing.
And how did you feel about that she was making your clothes up through high school?
She and I had some great bouts about clothes when she was sewing for me. And I couldn't wait to get out and earn my own money and buy clothes. I felt that all the things she made were ill-fitting, and but you know, she had fairly good taste. She really did. She was sort of artistically inclined. I think my son sort of got that from her. But my mother and her sisters and brothers were all very creative.
Your son Larry?
Yes, and I think he came by it from them. When I think about now, my brothers are all also very creative. My sister and I didn't inherit that. We never could sew a stitch. We weren't interested in crocheting or knitting. We tried, but we weren't good at it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier, before the tape was on, about your father talking about the food and the bread and butter.
Yes. My father would try to comfort his family when they wanted more things than he thought was that he could provide or that was necessary, and he would say, look at what you have here in America. Look at this table. You have white bread, you have butter, you have milk, you have cheese. Long after people stopped thinking of those things as luxuries. But he could not see putting out any money for going to the movies or buying an ice cream cone. That was more than was necessary for the sustenance of life or even the enjoyment.
What did your father do in the old country? He was a shoemaker. Mm. And how about here?
When he came here, first, I think he sold shoelaces door to door. And then when he had enough money, he bought a horse and he became a peddler. And and all during the war, I guess, he was a peddler. And that was a very lucrative thing to do during the war because little bits and pieces of metal and stuff was very precious at that time.
This is during World War One, while you were still.
Yes, World War One. Mm-hmm. Yes, and in the summertime he sold vegetables and fruit, and that's what he was doing when we came here. And then, after a while, as I told you before, you know, they had built this house, which they left to the care of my grandparents when we came here. And after a few years, they sold the house for them. I can't remember exactly how much money they got for it. But when the money arrived here, my father bought some more real estate. He bought two parcels, I think, two or three parcels of land with not terribly expensive stuff, but then he gave up his peddling, and he made a living out of that, renting out the. We call him the big real estate tycoon. But it was enough to sustain them. By that time, they only had their youngest son, who all through his school years, he helped with this property. He was taught how to, or he learned how to paint, put on paper, fix the plumbing. He did all that. And then, of course, he was in the Army.
This is your youngest
brother? My youngest brother.
And his name?
Matthew. And Matthew was their... Matthew was the true youngest son who was there to take care of his parents when all the others had married and left the home. And he did that. And he was a very loving son, and he cheerfully did all that. And then when he came back from the army, wait just a minute. We had never owned a car, but when Matthew turned 16, they bought a car. And he drove. And so it made life a little bit more interesting for them. And then when he came back from the Army, he went to college on the GI Bill. He went to Syracuse University. My other brother also was in the Army. And he went to, he went to Brooklyn, he went to Pratt. Now, I can't remember. No, that was not on the GI Bill. That was before the war. But he graduated Pratt and never could get a job doing what he was supposed to be doing. He wanted to teach, and he couldn't pass the oral test. They said he had a sibilant S or something. Mm. So he never really did what he was supposed to, you know, what would have been his milieu.
Is there anything else you can think of about being in an immigrant family in a small town, relatively small town in Massachusetts, during the 20s? Were there many immigrant families that had settled there?
There were about 100 or 125 people or something like that. And most of them were immigrant families. Some had come over there much earlier than my father. They had come over here perhaps in the greatest influx of immigration, which was in the 1890s, I think that was around the time when they came and settled there. Most of, I remember none of my friends had parents who were born here. I think two of my girlfriends had mothers who spoke with an American accent, because they came here as little girls. They had very little education. Going to high school when I was a young woman was like the goal. Like my oldest cousin and her brother, they never got to high school. They went to work after they graduated grammar school. And my parents felt, well, my sister never graduated high school. She left, well, she thought she was too old because she was 16 years old when she got out of grammar school, and she felt she was too old. No, 17, she was 17. And so she stayed around for a couple of years. She worked for a couple of years, and then she went to New York. And she met a man who was in the same situation she was in. And they got married. Very nice man. But when I think, had I lived in the city, I probably would have gone to college. Because colleges were available here. And I always felt that it was my parents' fault that I didn't go to school. But when I you know, finally looked at the whole thing, I decided it wasn't their fault, it was my fault. There was a teacher's, what they called a normal school, which was a two-year course. And I could have gone there for very little money had I really insisted that I wanted to go. But I was so anxious to get out there and wear clothes that, you know, it wasn't expected of me that I went to work and forgot all about college.
Were there children from other countries aside from Russia that had settled in North Adams at that time when you were growing up?
I don't remember any other immigrants at the time that we came over. Sort of, it was the tail end of immigration for Jewish people until the Second World War. So we were, you know, we were really the only children who were not in our generation, who were not born there. All the rest were born in North Adams.
Do you remember the Depression? Do you remember any personal effects of the Depression?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. There was a time when I was out of work. And I couldn't find another job. I think I was 19 or 20. And I remember one summer I had a two-piece dress, a skirt and sleeveless top. It was white. And I dyed it every color of the rainbow all summer long. And then my mother got a hold of a piece of material and made a little cotton thing for me. I was always starving for clothes. I always liked clothes. And my mother understood that because she herself liked clothes. And I always used to say, my mother put on everything she owned, every piece of jewelry. My mother could, she wore glasses and she wore earrings and she wore a necklace and she wore a pin. And she never looked overdressed. And it was strange because she really wanted to. Had she lived in New York away from, my mother had two sisters-in-law who intimidated her terribly.
How did they do that?
Well, they were very big, they were very tall, and they were big, and they were good looking. And they always took the opportunity to tell me that the first time they met her, they could not understand how their father could have married such an ugly woman. They did that to me. And they were always a little jealous of my mother, because my mother, the men always did like my mother. They liked her ways. My mother was very feminine, very sweet, took care of her house. She was never overbearing. My aunts were the modern, what would now be called women's lib people. One of my aunts always had a business. She had a shoe store. And she was the head of the family, so to speak. She should never have gotten married because she really didn't. Well, I don't know whether she didn't love him, but I can tell you she gave him a hard time. She was very, very, but they would come to my house and they would admire the way my mother did things. Her cooking and her baking and her sewing. And so they copied her in a way, but they took their revenge by always letting her know that she was not pretty, which was the silliest thing in the world. these old ladies would, you know. Hmm. But anyway, when in her old age, she, after my father died, my father died and she kind of fell apart. She would never had a well day after he died. She lived for about 3 or 4 years, but she was ill. She had a massive heart attack. And we brought her to New Jersey to be near us. And when she came to New Jersey, she had never had her hair cut because her sisters-in-law didn't approve of bobbed hair.
But she had been in the country now for...
Oh, many years. She never used makeup. I think secretly she did use a little bit of rouge, but secretly. But when she came here, she asked me if I thought it would be all right for her to have her hair cut. And I said, it certainly would. If you want it cut, we'll have it cut. That woman changed so much when she moved to New Jersey. And she told me what she, you know, the things that she wanted to do. She began to use a little bit of makeup, a little bit of lipstick. Oh, eyebrow pencil. She loved eyebrow pencil. When she was very ill in the hospital, I came to visit her one day. She wanted me to get her eyebrow pencil immediately. She was going to put some of that on. And she wore colors like, my mother had beautiful eyes. She had corn blue eyes, that were really noticeable. And she was very sweet looking. She had white hair. And actually, I look a lot like my mother. I never had any claims to looks, but I never felt ugly either. And I don't think she did either, actually.
To what do you attribute her new interests when she came to New Jersey in makeup?
I think she was expressing herself. I think that she always felt that she would have looked better had she been able to use makeup, which is true because she was very pale and sort of woebegone looking. Whether it was a little bit of makeup would have, you know.
But she hadn't used it because of her sister.
Yeah, she was afraid of them. Uh-huh. They were, one of them was very religious, the older one. And the other one was just naturally mean. I shouldn't say that, should I?
So, did your mother or father ever become citizens?
Mm. They did. They both became citizens. And my father always voted. I often wondered how he did that because he went to night school for a long time, but somehow or other, he just never could learn how to read properly. But he said he would study the ballot before, and if it was pointed out to him, he was always a Democrat, that this is Roosevelt right over here, or whoever, then he knew how to do that. And my mother was much more forward-going than my father. She tried things that would not have occurred to him. Not, you know, not that she wasn't kosher. Oh, yes, well, she never would eat anything that was. But she got so, for instance, my house was never kosher because I married a man whose family just were not they were not observant Jews. And although my mother-in-law confessed to me that she didn't like to cook bacon, she did it because the children wanted it, but she really didn't like it. So she'd say, now that you're here, you can cook it. But my mother never, but she would eat with us in a restaurant, and she would order a vegetable salad or some such thing. And she would even eat at my house if I had dairy or fish. She would even eat fish, I think. So I think, you know, had she lived in the city away from her sisters-in-law, she would have, you know, been much more free with what she was doing. I don't think my mother was ever all that religious. But my father was. Yeah.
And he maintained that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. My father was very religious. Mm-hmm. Although it was strange about my father, too. You know, when Dick was marrying Karen, my father knew it, but he made believe that he didn't know about it.
That is, he was marrying someone who
was not Jewish. Uh-huh. And had this happened 10 years before, he would have been tearing his hair out. But I guess he got tired, you know. I think he would get mellow or didn't have enough fight in him. Mm-hmm. And my mother was at the wedding.
Now, what did you do after you left high school? You started working. What
I
kind
worked.
Of a job did you
first? My first job was for I worked at the Western Union Telegraph Company. I learned how to run that machine that they used at that time. I don't know what they do now, but they had, it was like a typewriter, but it sent the telegrams to wherever they had to go, or some point from where they were
dispatched
to another point. It worked like a typewriter. And then when the telegrams came in, they came on a ribbon of paper, and you pasted them on a sheet. And I took messages over the telephone and things, you know.
And did you stay there a long time?
No, that's why I lost my job when the Depression came. And then I worked for Harry Wine, Gert's father. He had a shoe store. I did all his bookkeeping and sold shoes and swept the floor, all for $10 a week.
This was during the 30s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When I worked at the Western Union, I earned $12.10. That was my first check. But I talked to women who are my age in the city, and they earned about the same. Unless they were school teachers, and they earned a little bit more.
And how did you meet your husband?
He came to my sweet 16th birthday party as the date of one of my friends. She brought him. And she had raved about him before. That he was the handsomest and the most suave and very sophisticated. He was only a year and a half older than I was. But we were in the same class in high school. I don't know, he missed out a year, he was sick or something. And so shortly after that, and she was she would always tell me that you know, she had a terrible crush on him, and she had had some dates, or he had an uncle who lived in North Adams, and also his father didn't drive a car, so he would drive his parents to visit the uncle. And while he was waiting for them to visit the uncle, he would call her, and they would have a little get-together while they were waiting, and a lot of the time, it would only be like 15, 20 minutes, and she was going crazy with that. So I'd heard a lot about these things that happened between her and Abe. His name was Abe. And so then there was a group, the men's club at the community center had a dance once a year in February. it was a Valentine's dance, I guess, and it was formal and it was very important. It was the event of the year, the social event of the year. And I had not been to one as yet because I was only 18 years old or whatever. And so I just didn't think anything of it. I thought maybe somebody might ask me since I'm now a grown-up young woman, but maybe not. So one evening, the phone rang and there was Abe, and he's inviting me to go to this do. So I'm completely confused because I think, you know, he supposedly is Tilly's boyfriend. So I said, well, let me think about it for a little bit. You call back later. And I spoke to my mother about it. I told her that he was supposedly Tilly's boyfriend, but he wants me to go to the ball. We called it the ball with him, and I don't know what to do. So my mother is very practical. She said, well, he's asking you, not her, so go. So I did. Well, that was the beginning of it, but it wasn't until quite a few years later that we were married. We had kind of a stormy courtship because his father died in 1931, and his father had this clothing store, which at one time did very well, but was really limping along. So there wasn't very much money, and he was in no rush to get married, although I wanted to get married. And finally, we were married in 1936.
Mm-hmm. And would you give the names of your children?
Yes, my oldest son is Richard, and my second son is Larry, and my daughter's name is Jane. And I have five grandchildren and one great-grandchild.
When you think back about coming to this country at age 11 and making your life here, do you think the fact that you came here as an immigrant, as a little girl, made a difference on who you became or how you saw things or aspects of your later life?
Not really. Because for me it didn't. Because as I said before, somehow or other, I always wanted to be an American. I didn't think that anything that I had left behind was anything that I wanted to keep with me.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what being an American meant to you?
I think it meant America first. Now, whether this is true or not, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it being Jewish first. But to me, it's synonymous. I think you can be Jewish and you can be American.
Whereas in Russia, you couldn't be Russian.
You could not.
Jewish.
No. I always when I came to New York, to the New York area, I would often hear one of my sister-in-laws would have an expression, oh, that's very goyish. And I always resented that because that was supposed to be not good. And I could not equate that with anything that meant anything to me, because I knew people who were goyish who dressed better than I did and had taste that was impeccable. It did not have the connotation to me that it did to her. Are you familiar with any such feeling?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a prejudice.
It's a terrible prejudice that I disapprove of.
What when you think back over your life, what makes you feel satisfied that you've done or that you feel proud of?
I think probably my children. What else do I have? I never was terribly career minded. I did work. When my husband died, I worked in a drugstore selling cosmetics, and because my brother owned a drugstore, so I went to work for him. And then when I moved into the city, I worked for part-time for a magazine. What I did, you know, little odd jobs and things, bookkeeping and stuff. Nothing important, ever.
How was it that you came to move to New York?
Well, when my husband died, I lived in Adams, you know, small town. The boys of the older boy was in college, and the younger one was having a terrible time in school. He was giving everybody a rough time. And so my brothers all lived in the metropolitan area. Although my parents still lived in North Adams, but for me there was nothing left in Adams. I really didn't want to stay there anymore. I felt very vulnerable. I felt that all when people see me, they see me as Abe's widow. And somehow or other, it made me feel very, very sad. And I thought, maybe if I lived in a place where nobody knew that I was anybody's widow, I could I could get along better. But that is a whole other story. Because when I came and I lived around where my brother, especially my older brother, who kind of took over the running of me and mine, and I had to fight his constant surveillance and influence, which my children resented very much.
Do you think you've retained anything that you would call Russian?
Yes. Oh, yes. I think there's a core of me that responds to Russian. The language, the people. I have a feeling. For instance, I during the war, or right after the Second World War, there was a a factory in West, connected to New York. What was it now? They did business with Russia. Hmm. And they taught their people how to get along with the Russian people. They taught them a little Russian. Hmm. And that was on television. They had Russian lessons, but they were very technical because they were, I think what company was that? It wasn't the Sprague because that was in North Adams. Anyway, so I decided that I wanted to listen in on this program. But it went on at 6 o'clock in the morning. And my husband encouraged me. As a matter of fact, he bought me a book you know, a little Russian primer. And I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning before I got the children up for school. And I would come downstairs, make myself a cup of coffee, and I would take notes on this little lesson. And then I would call my mother. And I would say, you know what I learned this morning, Mom? I learned, you know, so many words and this and that. And I did, you know, Russian is, it's very easy to learn to read Russian because it's very phonetic. It's not like English. All you have to do is you learn the alphabet and you just put the words together. But knowing, and then you learn so many words. But then when you get into the grammar of it, it gets a little more difficult. But for a while there, I played around with it. And, you know, I was learning all these Russian words and being very proud of myself. So I did. I like Russian. For instance, I love the dancers, the Russian dancers. They kind of answer a certain thing in me that still responds. And especially the dancing, because I've always loved dancing. But I never did get too far with the Russian. Gave it up after a while. Getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning was not great.
And how about this period in your life?
Now
that you're retired and you're here in New York and your children are grown.
I enjoy whatever I can, whatever little thing I find to enjoy, I do. Because I always say, well, it's later than you think. I'm not terribly well. My heart is not all that good. And I realize that there may be not too much time left. So I try not to think about that. And I, as I say, I enjoy what I can. My grandchildren, my children, my remaining children. And I try not to get too depressed. If I do, I leave the house. And I go to the store or the library.
How did you feel when Ellis Island became a national monument and opened as a museum? Did you feel any personal connection with it?
I went there. I told you I went there once, and I tried to find the name, and whatever. However you do it, I could not. They didn't have it. Why that is, I don't know. I tried to spell it, you know, various ways. So I don't know why that is, but that's the first time I've ever been there since I came through. And the only thing I noticed was the that skylight, which is still there, I think.
Did you feel like it was somehow a tribute to you and your family?
Not really. I've never. I don't think I've ever sentimentalized it. Although from time to time people ask me questions like I'm supposed to know all about Russia. I guess it's in my bones. And I remember, what do I remember? I remember that we had a big orchard behind our house that spanned three houses, and each home owned a section, a third of that. And there were apples and pears and cherries and a lot of fruit, which my mother put into cans and things for the winter. And we ate apples and things, fresh fruit and canned fruit. Not cans, but jars, glass jars. And this is probably what sustained us, was the vegetables and fruits that we got from the garden. We always had a cow so that we had milk. When we came here, we had my father had a horse, I told you. And my mother insisted that he buy a cow, because what were we going to eat without a cow? And we had chickens. We lived sort of edge of town, and we had a chicken coop there, and she had chickens, so we had eggs. No wonder my father said, look what we have. We have milk, we have eggs, we have... And I guess it was the horn of plenty as far as my mother was concerned. So, yeah, boy, he was happy about that. Once I remember the cow wasn't giving milk anymore. And he sold the cow. And we got an idea that he had sold her to the local butcher. And for weeks, we would not touch meat. Her name was Bessie, because we thought we were eating part of Bessie, and we weren't going to do that. So.
Okay, well, is there anything else you can think of that we haven't covered that has to do with starting out in Russia, coming to this country?
Well, I'm still thinking of your question when you say, did I ever think that I was different because I had come here as an immigrant? And I say, no, I don't think so. But I suppose there was a part of me, an experience that I had that the others didn't have. And did it impede me, or was I more broad-minded because of that? Is a question that I don't know. Maybe so. Maybe in a way it made me different, I guess.
Did you develop any heroes when you came to this country? People maybe that were in the public light or actually individuals that you had contact with that you looked up to and wanted to emulate?
Oh, well, as I say, my eighth grade teacher mm-hmm. was one. And then later on, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt was my heroine. I think I probably had maybe a little bit more of the European habit of looking up to people more than the Americans do. And thinking that, my mother always said, always be friends with people you think know more than you do. Because from them you can always learn something.
Can you think of any other attitudes or ideas that your mother or father tried to instill in you? Perhaps you did the same with your children or not, but any ideas that they thought were important for you to live by?
I'll tell you. I think my mother and father, together with their whole generation, had a pattern of do's and don'ts. And I think they felt, do the best you can for yourself. And do the right things. And always look up. But don't look so far up that you're going to get yourself out of the running. Mm-hmm. And my mother-in-law, for instance, told her son to marry a rich girl. He didn't, but she told him to. I never did that to my children.
Was your mother-in-law an immigrant?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. She and her husband were married here. They came here as young people.
From Russia as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I guess they came to New York City originally. And they were married in New York City. And then they came out to Massachusetts for whatever reason, I don't know. But she wanted her son to marry a wealthy girl. I never had that kind of European attitude myself.
You think that was European?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Europeans, the European Jews are very class conscious. For instance, they have a pecking order. A tailor was better than a shoemaker, and the tailor's daughter would not marry a shoemaker's daughter. Some such, you know, thing went on. And I think it held over to some degree. When they came here, they sort of tried to. First, you know, in the town where I lived, in North Adams, they had a lot of people who were related to each other who came here because they were related. And they married one another. Cousins married cousins by the dozens. And one uncle married his niece and things like that. You know, if somebody was nice, they didn't want to let him out of the family. He married so-and-so's daughter or cousin or I don't know what. Until they realized that they were perpetuating a few little items that were not so great, such as diabetes. And so they stopped doing that eventually.
That was done a lot in the old country, wasn't it? Or not as much as here because...
Well, here in certain places, it was illegal. For instance, in Boston, I think it was illegal to marry a cousin. My uncle, my father's brother, and his wife were first cousins.
I hear that a lot about cousins marriage. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about your attitudes or what you tried to instill in your children?
I don't know what I wanted to instill in my children. I think I wanted them to be decent human beings. I wanted them to get as much education as they possibly could because they didn't do that, but I wanted them to. I never told them to. I stated my preference. I said that I would like it if they married Jewish people. They didn't. My daughter married a Jewish man. But. And my oldest son always said, well, I intended to, Mom. It just didn't turn out that way. I might say, as their mother, that the Jewish girls really lost out.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. I want to thank you so much for a wonderful interview. This has been Sonia Sokolov. And I've been speaking with her on November 19th, 1995 in New York City. This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm signing off.
Pragmatic and very, they go with who might be the best catch for them. Who might be, and neither one of my sons looked like they were going to be that. Larry always said when we talked about it, he'd say, what Jewish girl would have wanted to marry me? And this is true.
Okay, well, we're at the... Thank you. I've been speaking with Sonia Sokolov, and this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service. It's November 19th, 1995. We're here in New York City in Mrs. Sokolov's home, and I am signing off.